You knew Burns from Columbia. You were a colleague of his.
Well, my knowledge of Burns sort of covers a long period with a lot of gaps. I mean, my first job after my degree at Chicago was at the National Bureau, and I was, Friedman fixed me up, thought I was a National Bureau type of person, and I was going to be Burns's assistant there. And but before I got there, he had already left for Washington, so I became Jeff Moore's assistant. Then he was really in and out of Washington during that whole period. But then there was a period when I went to Columbia. Then let's see, I went to Columbia. I gotta remember these dates now. I went to Columbia. Let's see, I was 2 years at the National Bureau, then back to Chicago for 3 years. Let's see, when I left Brown, I went to Columbia. That was in, oh God, I'm forgetting dates now. That was in, I guess the 60s. Must have been in the 60s. Anyway, at that time, Burns was still at Columbia, but he was sort of, I remember just before Nixon was elected the first time, Burns got involved in the thing, and he was aware of it. We couldn't get him to do anything in the department, even though he was supposed to be a full-time member. So he was there briefly, so I didn't really see too much of him then. He went back to Washington. And so then I would, while he was in Washington all those years, I mean, a couple of times I would have when I was on the council, for example, and things like that. I remember when I was to go to the council under McCracken, let's see, that was in 68, 69. Burns, I guess, hadn't quite gone to Washington yet, because I remember he was still at the National Bureau, and I went in to ask him about going to the council and, you know, get his opinion and talk to him then. And then when I was in Washington, then he was practically there, I guess, at the same time. He became counselor to the president.
Right.
And I had one or two run-ins with him there, just because we're in the same building or something, but really not much. Then I saw him at Friedman's. We had a big feshra for Friedman. That was 19... When was that? At Virginia. I forget the date. It was his 60th birthday, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I ran into Burns there. And then after he left Washington and I was at the American Enterprise Institute, he was there then at that time, too. So we overlapped a little bit at that. I saw him, had several run-ins with him at that point. So, and then I remember the last time really was the American Enterprise Institute had a big special dinner in Burns' honor, which that was the last time I saw him, I think. So it was sort of on and off throughout that period.
Does my memory serve me? Didn't I hear you once tell a story about how Burns took care of Mitchell when he was dying and...
No, I didn't know. That wasn't from me. It might have been from Mel Friedman. I don't know. That wasn't me, no, because I don't have any recollection of that at all. That goes way back before my time, as a matter of fact, because Mitchell was long dead before I came to the National Bureau.
I guess he died in the early 50s. You didn't have much idea of kind of Burns's economics before you went to the council in 69? You know, in terms of conversations with him or...
Well, I guess not. At some time along the way, but that must have come later, I had a feeling he didn't have a real good feel for monetary theory, but of course he was an excellent business cycle person, and that heard stories that he was an excellent teacher at Columbia, and particularly during that period when there was a lot of talk about Keynesian theory, he apparently gave a course of going into a lot of, and I guess highly critical of the Keynesian approach, but I didn't have any direct knowledge of any of that, no.
Mm-hmm. How did you get your job at the consul? It wasn't through Burns then.
No. I suppose that McCracken might have... he probably talked to Milton Friedman, I guess, and Friedman... I really don't know. McCracken called me and asked me if I was interested, and I said yes, and we had a dinner, I remember, in which he interviewed and got to know me a little bit better, and then he offered me the position. I was just a senior staff member there, sort of in charge with monetary stuff. So when I first went there, it was McCracken, and then Hank Hightacker was the macro person, so I sort of worked with him. And then, let's see, Stein. When did Stein come? I sort of forget that because I remember I first worked with Hightacker, but then during most of it I worked with Herb Stein.
Stein was there from the very beginning. It's just that he became chairman after McCracken.
No. When by the time he became chairman, I had left. I was only there for a year and a half. I'm trying to remember how he fitted in with Hightacker, because I remember...
Well, the original council was McCracken as chairman, and Stein and Hightacker as...
Yes, that's right. Yeah, now I get it. Yeah, Hightacker was the international person,
right.
I guess, and Stein was more domestic. Yeah, so I did work with Stein from the beginning.
Right, and then when Hightacker left, he was replaced by Solomon, and then Solomon was replaced by Marina von Neumann.
Yeah, well, that came after left, yeah.
So, basically, how did you spend your days? Did you have time to do research into money?
What I mostly did was to try to, what I mostly did was to watch the money supply and what the Fed was doing and take some part in their predictions of what was going to happen. And then there was a little bit of research. I remember they wanted to do inflation was bad, so there was a lot of talk about how inflation was going, and I remember there was we wanted to do a study of how the liquidity of firms or something, I forget the detail. That was started while I was there, and then they published that, I think, it was an appendix or something in one of the subsequent reports of the council, but I had left by then. Now, I remember I was constantly... I think at that time I was using a little bit of the Anderson Jordan St. Louis approach, you know, running GMP on money supply and trying to figure out what was likely to happen. I don't have a feeling that I played a very central role at that time. There was a lot of mail to answer. One of the interesting things I remember was that when anybody sent a letter to the council, monetary policy, and that was sent to me. I drafted the letter, and McCracken would look it over and send it out, but we didn't do it right away. Whereas if a letter was sent to the to the White House, and it involved monetary or economic matters, it was sent over to us, and it had a little red tag on it, which meant that we had to get it back to them within 24 hours. I remember I handled several of those. People complaining about high interest rates at that time. So I tried to tell them that it was unfortunate, but this had to be the way it was if we were going to get the inflation rate down and things like that. So I had answered letters, and we had a preliminary computer set up. I used to go up to the emergency, had some offices up there. They had a computer up in a corner, which was attached to some computer, so I could run little regression programs off of that. I remember doing that a lot. We had an old Wang calculator in my office. And so I did a lot of stuff, but frankly, I don't think it amounted to very much. Wasn't really sophisticated stuff. And then in terms of basic research, no. It was mostly keeping up on things.
Mm-hmm. I'm especially interested in your understanding of how McCracken and Stein viewed monetary policy. I have, of course, talked to both of them. McCracken called himself Friedman-esque. studying kind of McCracken and, you know, talking to him, my feeling overwhelmingly was that he was basically mainstream economist, had a knowledge of Friedman and St. Louis, but he really operated mostly as a business economist.
Well, I think that's right, yeah. He was sympathetic to monetarism, but he was a very moderate, wide-ranging person, very concerned about not being too ideological about anything. So, I mean, he knew I was a monetarist. That didn't seem to bother him at all, and Stein also was very much like McCracken, very broad, felt that money supply was important, but they weren't, they didn't feel, as Friedman did, that the policy should rigidly follow a certain rate of growth of the money supply. I don't think they thought that that was necessary or wanted to push for that. In any case, the Fed, they felt that the Fed ran the boat there, and therefore all they could do was sort of keep an eye on what was going on and offer their opinions, but I don't think there was any sense of putting pressure, or at least I'm not aware of it, putting pressure on the Fed to do anything. I remember one incident. I'm so naive about things. As soon as I got there, I started getting calls from newspaper people. I remember one fellow by the name of Wilson. I think he worked for Business Week. I'm not sure. But he was very clever. He'd start out by asking me general questions, you know, why this, why that. And I sort of, taking the role as being an economic teacher to him. And then, so he kept in touch with me that way. Then somewhere along the way, there was the news played up some kind of brouhaha between the council and the Fed, which where Burns was at the time. I really had no knowledge of that because whatever went on there was between McCracken, Stein, and the Fed itself, where they used to meet with them, I guess, once a week to talk things over. And I guess there was, I forget the details, but there was some disagreement about policy, and it got into the news. So this fellow Wilson calls me, and naturally I start talking more about anything I knew. So I thought, as far as I could tell, that there was no big deal going on. I used the word, I thought it was overblown, that there was this big controversy between the council and the Fed. And whether there was or not, I don't really know. But anyway, so he wrote an article in which he puts overblown in quotes, indicating that he got it from someone. And I don't know whether McCracken thought that it was me or not, but anyway, I got a copy of this article sent to me through the inner office mail, and a statement, not personally, but indirectly from McCracken, that he didn't want the staff to talk to the press. So the next time Wilson called me, I told the secretary to tell him that Mr. McCracken didn't want us to talk to the press, so that was the end of it. And so whether there was, I remember that one episode. I don't remember any other episodes where there was a talk of a severe controversy between the council and the Fed. There may well have been some disagreement at that time because inflation was raging. And so I remember the Fed wasn't doing very much about it, which I think was more or less Burns's attitude, that he was very much concerned about doing anything that would be disruptive to the economy.
Mm-hmm. In 1969, money stopped, M1 stopped growing about April and didn't grow for about 6 months.
Yeah, that I remember very well. Yeah, that was when I first came to the council. And so I wrote about that in my book, Persistent Inflation. At the time, it looked as though beginning early in the year, the money stock wasn't growing at all. And so we kept expecting, this is going to cause a recession. And McCracken was prepared for that. He was talking about the valley, he called it, in which there would be a little disruption, but then things would be fine on the other side. And so he and Stein, as far as I know, accepted the idea that this restrictive monetary policy to bring inflation down would produce a mild recession. They hoped it would be very mild. They were planning on it being very mild. And this would bring inflation down, and then things would be fine thereafter. So it looked as though the money stock wasn't growing at all, and so we kept waiting for the economy to slow down, which it didn't right away. And I remember this fellow, Pierre Rinfrey, at the time saying that the high interest rates people were complaining about due to the fact that money supposedly wasn't growing, and a lot of people saying this isn't going to do any good. The high interest rates is just going to disrupt business. It isn't going to do anything about inflation. And I felt that was all crazy, but I was a little concerned about the fact that nothing much was happening. But finally, the economy did turn down at the end of the year. When I looked at this later by the revised money stock, it turned out that the money stock really hadn't slowed down until it was after April that it slowed down, not at the beginning of the year. And so that the time that it took for this slowdown to hit the economy was about on target. But at the time, we were sort of worried about this and concerned, and I didn't know how to explain this. I just knew that this couldn't go on indefinitely, but it was a little disconcerting at the time. So the economy went into recession in 1970 then, and it was a mild recession, so things weren't too bad. The problem was that the prices didn't slow down. They kept going. And this was very disconcerting, and this seemed like something new that we weren't prepared for.
Yeah, it really caused consternation in the economics profession.
Yeah, well, when I looked at this later, I realized my interpretation was is that from one recession to the next, it was a little bit harder to get this inflationary momentum out of the economy, and it was just taking longer, and that it didn't start immediately as soon as the recession came, but it would come with a lag after that, which in fact it did. The trouble is that they revved up the economy right away too much, and while we did get some decline in the inflation rate, it took off again shortly after that. The problem was that they didn't, as I viewed it later, that when you come out of the recession, you give the economy a little bit of extra money to get it going, but you watch it very carefully. You don't let that go too far, and that's exactly what Burns did. He let it go too far.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that reflects the fact that he thought monetarism was crazy, that the world was much too complicated, I think of all the things that he looked at, I think the money supply was at the bottom of his list.
Yeah, he emphasized confidence.
Yeah, confidence. He was very concerned about that. But
and
he always talked about expectations getting built in and so on. But once they got built in as they were, I don't know what his philosophy was in getting them down again.
Well, wage controls.
I had to miss that.
What?
I missed some of the words from this thing. We didn't hear what you did.
Oh, wage controls. Was
wage
a way
controls,
of dealing with
yeah.
expectations.
Yeah, that's right. Burns, right. You're quite right. I forgot about that for the moment. He felt that, that's another indication. He felt that you couldn't bring the economy down with a tight monetary policy because of these expectations built into wages and everything else that would just go on as ever, and you'd just push the economy down into the gutter, and that therefore you had to act directly on these expectations. Yeah, that was his view. Yeah.
In October of 1969, by then M1 had not grown for considerable time.
Since April, according to the later figures, and it didn't grow, as I remember, until the end of the year.
Yeah. At that point, George Shultz wrote a memo to Nixon complaining about the lack of money growth, and in response, both Burns and McCracken signed a memo telling Nixon that there was not going to be a recession, that that Shultz was being alarmist. I think that
in October.
Yes,
that surprises me a little, because I certainly figured that we were on the road to a recession, and I don't remember discussing it specifically with Stein, but I'm sure we had a lot of talk together. I can't believe that he didn't believe this either. And as a matter of fact, McCracken, I don't remember when, but I remember he gave this speech about this, using this term, the valley that I mentioned, that,
right,
that there was going to be a slowdown into a valley and then we were going to come up on the other side. And I remember that specifically because when he was going to give this speech, he was out of town, and the White House, and Nixon was going to do some talk, and the White House wanted to know what McCracken was going to say. So they called me to the phone to give a synopsis to the speechwriter at the White House about this speech that McCracken was going to give, and I had read it, and I did give that synopsis. So where this response to this memo sort of surprises me a little bit, unless I don't know what it meant.
Well, I mean, again, I'm just primarily working off the memos that were sent.
You have probably a lot more insights than I did, because I was definitely on the outside of all of that loop.
At this point, I mean, the idea was that the unemployment rate would have to rise moderately above 4%.
I remember the hope was that it was going to stay below 5, if I remember correctly. That's what McCracken was counting on.
But there, I don't think in McCracken's mind that qualified as a recession. I think that in his mind it qualified as a slowdown in growth. And until they actually saw a reduction in inflation, I think he was afraid that the administration would back off too soon.
I see. You mean he was getting out of it semantically by pretending that this was not a recession but just a slowdown?
Well, I don't think he thought. I think he thought that.
Well, I thought it was a recession. I mean, there was going to be actually a decline in output, which would make it a recession rather than a slowdown. But I don't remember having any specific discussions with him about anything like that.
In November, he first becomes concerned, at least in the memos, about money growth, suggesting that Nixon talk to the Fed. But then he says we should move money growth up to the 2 to 4% range. So at that point, it's not that's not a very vigorous response. It's only in December when actually the incoming data are pretty convincing that the economy is slowing down, that he then becomes more concerned. Although it's really not until late spring that both the Fed and the council really think there's going to be a sustained a real recession rather than just a slowdown.
Well, that could well be, yeah, because it was hard to read the data, and the data came in late.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there was an awful lot of complaint in the economy about the monetary policy was too tight. I forget what did interest rates look like. They must, I don't remember in detail, but they must have been going up.
Well, in '69 they were. I suppose the prime rate was 9%. I mean,
for the United States,
it was historically high.
And there was an awful lot of complaint. I'm sure Nixon was very sensitive. I mean, these people, it wasn't like later in the Reagan administration. I mean, at this time, there was a considerable concern about unemployment. It was a very, very hot issue.
Yeah.
And they were scared to death about it.
I think the feeling was that they could move the unemployment rate up in a controlled way to just moderately above 4%, keep it there, and work the inflation rate down gradually, and they overestimated
it. Yeah, right. The word was gradualism at that time. I remember we were all using that. We were going to do it gradually, and therefore it wouldn't hurt too much. Subsequently, I thought that was a big mistake, because gradualism basically doesn't work, I think. But at that time, that was the idea.
But I think there was a feeling that they could maintain that degree of control over the unemployment rate and then move the inflation rate down in a measured, controlled way. But they, in fact, weren't able to exercise the degree of control they thought over.
Well, the problem was, I think, that the policy, when the inflation rate didn't appear to be responding to this slowdown in the 70s, people went, maybe even panicked, I don't know, but it threw them off their trajectory. I mean, they didn't know what to do then, and they, then there was this talk about the controls and things like that, and I'm sure Nixon was all concerned about it, and therefore they felt, well, they couldn't hold this tight monetary policy any longer, and of course what they should have done was have a moderate recovery in monetary growth, but not overdo it, sort of keep the economy, pressure on the economy, which of course would mean that the unemployment might be higher than people thought it would be for a period of time. But they didn't do that. They let the thing get away from them.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else I should ask you about your experience at the council, or anything else come to mind? I read your letter, and I appreciate that, and that was very...
Yeah, well, I told you some, I don't know if I told you some personal things. I might add this, which is very personal.
Okay.
When I talked to Burns about going to the council, and he was then reminiscing about his knowledge of McCracken,
yeah.
And he said something that I always remember. He said that, well, he was with McCracken in a meeting once, a long meeting in which things were discussed, and he noticed that McCracken changed his views slightly towards the end of the meeting than from what they were at the beginning, indicating to Burns, who was very sensitive to this sort of thing because he was a very tough character and he wouldn't change his mind about anything, that McCracken obviously was a mild type of person who would be influenced by pressures and so on. And I hadn't ever thought of people in that way, but it indicated to me that how Burns viewed McCracken, which I think was probably right. McCracken was probably the type of person who would moderate his views in a long discussion after he heard what other people had to say. Whereas Burns wouldn't. Burns knew exactly what his opinion was, and he was going to fight for it right to the end. And he was like that. He
exactly,
loved
yeah.
Washington, and he loved the infighting in Washington. Another little thing I remember, which is also personal, later on, when Burns was at the Fed, they had some big conference there in which I was invited, and they had a big luncheon. And they, people were, there must have been about 50 people. There were a lot of different tables for luncheon, and everybody was assigned a seat at all of these tables. And when I got there, it turned out that I was assigned a seat right next to Burns. And whereas Milton Friedman, at this time, Milton and Burns, they were still friends, but their objection had become public because Milton had written that Newsweek article in which he criticized Burns' Fed policy. So I sort of had a feeling that Burns put me there because he knew I was not a threatening kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't cause any problems for him. And during that dinner, during that luncheon, Burns told us how pleased he was because there had been something going on in Congress to clip the independence of the Fed. And Burns fought this tooth and nail and finally won in the committee considering this legislation. I think it was 14-12 or something he had won. And he was sort of almost gloating over this victory, very pleased. And it made me realize how he loved this Washington infighting and how political he was as a person, really, that he viewed his position there. I mean, he was the head of the Fed, and he was there to protect the Fed, and this involves a lot of infighting with Congress, in which Burns would go over and lobby people and pressure them and talk to them and so on. And he apparently did a great deal of this in order to win in this particular committee meeting. And I remember his commenting about it. It had just happened and how pleased he was that they had won, according to him.
Yeah, that's of course exactly right. McCracken was not a dominating sort of personality or figure. I mean, he's just a very genial, pleasant sort of...
Yeah, definitely. Person. I remember McCracken saying once while I was there that some people can't see the facts right in front of their face. In other words, implying that they're so ideological that they can't see enough to realize that their position is not appropriate or that things are just not happening the right way. So you're right. He was not ideological. Very much concerned about paying attention to what's happening and not having a rigid preconception of things, but being able to change his mind or see what was really required under the circumstances. So he was that type of person. He did have some principles, of course. You may remember that when he was opposed to wage and price controls, and Nixon did it apparently because he felt he had to. But anyway, just after Nixon imposed wage and price controls, the Citibank newsletter came out with something that McCracken had written. I don't think it was a speech. I don't know, it was something he'd written. Anyway, it was a page and a half argument against the use of wage and price controls. And this came out just after. It was in the mail, it couldn't be stopped, just after Nixon imposed wage and price controls. So McCracken, I guess, felt he was forced out. I think he just felt that under the circumstances he should resign, and he did shortly after that.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I think that was a response to Galbraith's attack on Nixon, and what it showed was that...
Did you see the piece that McCracken wrote in that article?
What I've seen is the piece that Stein wrote at the end of July, and that has to be similar to what McCracken wrote. And I'm assuming it's they were both done in response to criticisms by John Kennedy.
Yeah, that probably was true.
They then differentiated themselves by saying that the Galbraith wanted permanent controls and they wanted just temporary controls to get through the period. But McCracken had come around to the position that controls were acceptable as a temporary measure.
But I wasn't aware of that then, yeah.
This is in a memo to Nixon. And he also pushed very hard for the establishment of a special court to try abuses of economic crimes. That is, there would be a special prosecutor who would bring cases against large corporations and labor unions for outsized price and pay increases, abusing their economic power. So, I mean, you know, as you say, he was affected by this stagflation, and people responded differently to it, but most people thought it was wage push.
Well, why did he resign then?
Well, in this respect, McCracken and Burns were really very close in how they saw the situation,
and
how they interpreted the stagflation. They both saw it as an abuse of the monopoly power of labor unions, and since they couldn't confront the labor unions directly with labor law reform, they thought that some form of incomes policy was the best way. McCracken said he resigned because he first of all had to make a choice. If he wanted to go back to the University of Michigan, he didn't have any more leave, and he had to make a choice of either going back.
You mean so he would have resigned anyway, no matter what happened? I remember there was something about
What most people have told me is that he really didn't like the sort of the bare knuckles part of campaigning, that part of the job where you get out and give speeches, and he didn't want to become heavily involved in the re-election of Nixon in 72.
I remember that Stein made a comment about how much he was being asked by the White House to go out and make speeches, which he didn't like, but he did it. He was willing to do it.
Well, I'm sure Stein didn't like it, but Stein was very good at it.
Stein
had a prima donna personality, and he liked attention. He liked the kind of thrust and parry with in public appearances. So I think that I really think that was the major reason, and I don't think Nixon objected because at that point the council had become pretty much irrelevant. At that point, by the summer of 71, kind of the issue was whether George Shultz or John Conley was going to be the primary kind of formulator of economic policy. When the council couldn't deliver on its gradualist program, they became kind of more and more irrelevant. But Stein had a very different personality. Stein seemed to be much more entrepreneurial. So Stein was the one who organized the pressure on the Fed. So he seemed to have had a much more aggressive personality than McCracken. And when the decision was made to go to controls, Stein was the one who had the kind of broad knowledge and the ability to actually help put it into practice. So Stein ended up being very much kind of sort of a part of the 72 program, although Stein had kind of long-run kind of principles, and ultimately, I mean, it's ironic, he had a lot to do with pressuring the Fed, he had a lot to do with the actual, Shultz and Burns kind of set the broad guidelines for the wage price controls, but Stein's the one who saw that the program got implemented along with Treasury people. But then kind of ultimately Stein had, you know, was very much of a free market person, and he and George Shultz were the ones who eventually got the thing unwound.
Yeah. Well, that sounds right to me. I think you have that right, yeah. Best I know them, yes.
Well, I just was very interested on your observations on these individuals, and you know, it's pretty much kind of the kinds of things I would have thought. I mean, definitely Burns just loved the mantle of power, and he felt that he deserved it.
Too. I don't know if I'd use the word power, but I think he loved he liked winning, and he liked to fight. Yeah, he enjoyed the process of using the power, I guess, more than just the power that he could call it. He was a very imposing person. I mean, I can see how he could rule the FMOC by just his personality. He was a forceful person, and to disagree with him would take a very strong person. I think it wouldn't be easy because he was smart and effective in his arguments, and you sort of feel the pressure of him, and I think I think he probably ruled that committee pretty well what he wanted. And so whatever they did, I think, should be attributed to Burns.
Yeah, but there's a darker side to that in that some of the chairmen Martin and Volcker and Greenspan, they all dominated the committee too, but in different ways. Burns had to have his way all the time, and he was not above using sarcasm and kind of condescension, belittling people, and
well, that I've never seen, but I can believe it.
Burns could not tolerate any dissent. I mean, of course, he would let the FOMC talk, but he knew what he wanted when he went into a meeting, and he got it when he came out.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm sure that's true. Yes.
You mentioned you worked with Jeffrey Moore. Should I call him? He was in the Nixon administration, too. Wasn't he in the Bureau of Labor Statistics?
Yeah, he was head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Well, I don't know if he was involved much in any of the things that you're talking about, but he certainly knew Burns very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that when in Nixon's second term, when they sent around this letter asking everybody to send in a letter of resignation, when they accepted Jeff's resignation, he was very put out. And I know Burns went to bat for him and tried to get it reversed, but Alderman and them were adamant, and Jeff wasn't taken back. Of course, what they didn't like was that Jeff, I forget, in some public testimony about the unemployment rate, I don't know what it was, whether he said we were in a recession or something like that, and the administration didn't like it and held that against him. I guess they felt, well, this guy speaks his mind. He's not a loyal team player, and so he was banished.
Yeah.
And Burns went to bat for him, and so they were very close. Yes. And Jeff has lost his sight, and I don't know. I haven't seen him for some time, and I don't know what how healthy he is now. But as far as I know, he's still alive.
Hmm.
But he's blind, practically blind.
Hmm. But as far as you know, he's capable of talking.
Oh, yeah, his mind is fine, yeah. Okay, yeah, give him a call. That might be a good idea. If you want to touch base with everybody who knows a little bit about all of this, he's another possibility, yeah.
Yeah, well, the Nixon was always down in the Labor Department. He thought it was a Jewish conspiracy to undercut him.
Well, could well be, but that was, but he had no, but that wouldn't be true of Jeff Moore. I mean, Moore had nothing to do with the rest of the Labor Department. He felt that he was a technical person in charge of statistics at the BLS, and he did some good things there. He fixed up some of their data, and, you know, he was very good with statistics and in a very practical way, concerned about their biases and things like that, and that's what he worked on. And then when he testified, he just, you know, he knew a lot about business cycles, and so he just told them what the truth was. Didn't occur to him that he had to be a, you know, have any particular point of view because of the administration's problems. I think probably didn't even think that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the BLS people would, when an unemployment figure would come out, they would say, well, it dropped, but that's, we got problems with the seasonal and the data at this time of year, and it may not be a permanent thing. And Nixon always took that as though they were trying to undercut any sort of good news about the economy, and thought that they were trying to, that this was sort of a conscious effort to, I mean, Guy was sort of paranoid about this. So.
Yeah, I guess that was Nixon's big problem. He was very smart, and he was very good about a lot of things, you know, domestic policy as well as foreign policy, but I guess he had this paranoid streak, which I guess is not uncommon in Washington, I guess, because
yeah.
It's obvious they play hardball in Washington, as we see even
yeah.
now, and when you're in that atmosphere, you it may not be paranoia. It may be that you're quite right. People are out to get you, but
yeah.
He obviously overdid it, Nixon, so... That's a story in and of itself, I guess.
Sure. Okay, well, I've